Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 29th of April, these are our main stories. The leader of the paramilitary force fighting Sudan's army has told the BBC he'll take part in peace talks if there's a pause in hostilities. The European Union has averted a crisis over Ukraine's crop exports with a deal that will allow them to continue passing through Eastern Europe. And Iran says it will reopen its embassy in Saudi Arabia within days. Also in this podcast,
a therapy that's using some of the healthy and good gut bacteria that obviously come out when you do a poo, but it's taking those so that when you take the pill, you're taking tens of millions of these healthy gut bacteria.
FDA approval for a pill derived from human waste bacteria to fight dangerous gut infections. Since hostilities broke out in Sudan on April the 15th, hundreds of people have died, thousands have fled, and declared ceasefires have been only sporadically observed. Now, though, the leader of the paramilitary group fighting the army, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti, says he is ready for peace talks if there is a cessation of hostilities.
We agreed to another truce last night and made a commitment. Unfortunately, the government continues bombing us from their airplanes relentlessly since the morning. These people are not committed to the ceasefire. I have no problems with the truce. It's for the Sudanese people. We sacrifice our souls for the Sudanese people and democratic transition.
The current agreed ceasefire, which began on Thursday night, just as the previous equally shaky one ran out, hasn't stopped fighters looting and torching markets and banks. Brenda Kariuki from the World Food Programme said humanitarian supplies are also being stolen.
As the fighting rages on in parts of Sudan, our humanitarian operations in the country are virtually impossible at a time when a third of the country is in desperate need of assistance. We are hearing of acute shortages of food, water, fuel, medicines, and access to healthcare. WFP staff, officers, and vehicles and equipment and foodstuffs have come in the direct line of fire, and looting of our warehouses continues.
And it's become clear that some of the fighting is happening in the western region of Darfur, which still bears the scars from the deaths and damage dealt out by the precursor to General Hemeti's RSF, the Janjaweed, 2 decades ago. Our Africa correspondent, Catherine Biarahunga, is following what's going on.
We've been getting testimony from civilians there who say there has been extreme violence over the last few days. They accuse Arab militias of attacking homes, markets. Some civilians even talk about seeing trucks full of dead bodies. According to humanitarian organizations, dozens of people have been killed in this violence. Today, the medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières said that a hospital it partners with, the main referral hospital in El Janina, the main city in West Darfur, has been attacked. It has been looted. Why this is concerning is obviously because Darfur has experienced decades of violence. In the early 2000s, there was a lot of killing, civilian deaths carried out by Arab militias, women raped. It was essentially called a genocide by some aid organizations. So the fact that once again it's being caught up in another round of conflict is of particular concern.
And what about the rest of the country? Are you getting a picture of what's going on elsewhere?
What we heard overnight from the warring sides in this conflict in Sudan is that they had officially agreed to a new ceasefire, their second this week. But when you tell Sudanese that the warring sides say there's going to be a ceasefire, they say, well, we don't believe it. And that's because continuously every day, people are hearing the sounds of gunfire, bombardments. There was a Turkish evacuation flights that was trying to land at this airstrip in the north of the capital to try and evacuate civilians. It came under fire. The rapid support forces, the paramilitary group, is accusing the army of targeting some of its positions. But in other parts of the country, we're now hearing of more evacuations happening, including in Port Sudan, in the east of the country. There, once again, civilians trying to get out.
Catherine Biarahanga. Beating Russia is now the main task for everyone in Europe, says President Zelensky of Ukraine, as he and his country count the cost of the latest Russian airstrikes. On Friday, there were at least 25 deaths, some of them children. Russia said its military had targeted Ukrainian army reserve units, but that's not what the pictures have shown. Our correspondent in Ukraine, Hugo Bachega, sent this report.
After weeks of quiet, the terror of Russia's missiles returned to Ukraine. This time, it's Uman that's counting the dead. A town away from the front lines that until today had been largely spared the brutality of this war. Vanda was woken up by the sound of a huge blast.
We were in our beds. We wanted to open the door to help people because children were screaming. One child was screaming in the flat next to ours, but everything collapsed.
The missile hit the top of the building. As residents were sleeping, many were trapped under the rubble. And all day here, there was a massive effort to try to rescue people alive.
Among those missing is Natalia's stepson, Yaroslav. She clings to what hope she has left.
We pray so much. A small part of his flat's kitchen was left standing. Maybe there is a chance he could still be found alive.
Across the country, the devastation could have been worse if it wasn't for the Ukrainian air defense. The military said all but two of the 23 missiles that Russia had fired were shot down. Ukraine is getting ready for an offensive to try to take back occupied territory. Today's attacks could be an indication of how Russia is likely to respond.
Hugo Bachega. Meanwhile, the European Union has reached a deal which will allow Ukraine to continue exporting its crops through neighbouring countries. Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Bulgaria had introduced restrictions on Ukrainian produce like wheat, saying it was undercutting their domestic prices. Here's Paul Moss.
This is a relief for all sides. The European Union has been a staunch ally of Ukraine since Russia invaded, so it was a spanner in the works of this warm relationship when Eastern European farmers started complaining about all the cheap Ukrainian agricultural produce coming across their borders. Ukraine's normal export route through the Black Sea has been restricted because of the war, and the crops were always supposed to be merely passing through Europe on their way to countries further afield. The EU says it will now make sure that happens and will compensate farmers for any loss of livelihood.
Paul Moss. Next to India, and a spate of killings has reignited a debate about whether laws designed to protect cows, an animal held sacred by the country's Hindu majority, are being used to target Muslims. Vigilante cow protection groups, which are often linked to right-wing Hindu factions, say they help police enforce laws banning the slaughter of cattle. But they've been blamed for a number of recent high-profile deaths, as our correspondent Leila Nathu reports from northern India.
Namaste. Nighttime by the side of a highway in the northern state of Haryana, and we've come to meet a cow protection squad. So we've got in the car with Pradeep and his group. They are showing us the area where they normally cover when they get information that there may be somebody carrying cows illegally or carrying beef. They come out on the roads and they're showing us some of the places where they have stopped people. They go around in a 4x4. It's got a big grate over the windscreen. There are men piled in the back seats. There's a loudspeaker on top of the car, and just above the number plate, it's written cow protection. Cows are sacred to Hindus, and the slaughter of the animals is illegal in most of India. Pradeep shows us where just days ago they stopped a truck packed with cattle and called police.
We get angry, but we also felt happy that we saved them from getting slaughtered. There are those killing cows, and there are those saving them.
Across the state, another cow protector, Monu Manisa, has long been boasting about his work online, posting photos and videos of himself with weapons and of chases and encounters with trucks on the roads. But he's now a suspect in the recent murder of two men, Junaid and Nasir, whose burnt remains were found in the torched wreckage of their car. We've just arrived at Junaid and Nasir's village. It's a peaceful place separated from some rocky hills by fields of mustard. Nasir lived here with his wife in one room next to his two brothers. A shaded area has been set up to receive visitors where people can gather underneath. And just next to it, there are piles of stones. Nasir had been preparing to build a new home. We're just walking up the road now to find Junaid's family at the other end of the village. Junaid's wife, Sajida, now has six children to look after by herself. She's wrestling with what happened.
Their bodies were brought in a bag. It was ashes. There was nothing else. Just a handful of ashes and a few bones.
The killings have captured attention across India, jogging memories of a previous wave of violence linked to cow vigilantes. Muslims in this area fear they're being targeted by the groups who are linked to right-wing Hindu factions. And we found evidence suggesting there was another victim earlier this year. Waris died after being involved in a car crash. The collision was captured on CCTV, which shows another vehicle with a siren on its roof approaching moments after. It's not a police car. An eyewitness filmed a gang of men then pulling a cow from the car's boot. And a video of Waris, then alive, being questioned, was streamed live from the Facebook account off the notorious vigilante Monu Manisa that night. Outside Waris's family home, we meet Shalkeen, who'd been travelling in the same car. He says they were being chased by a cow protection patrol in a 4x4, who beat them up so badly after the collision that Waris died from his injuries.
It was not an accident. He was killed. They are targeting Muslims. There was not a single injury from the crash.
Monu Manisa denies involvement in any of the deaths, and police say they're not investigating Waris's case. There is a sprawling cow protection network in this part of northern India. Dharminder Yadav, a senior figure in the movement here, insists they always work alongside police and within the law.
If someone harasses a woman, should we wait for police? Our enemy is the cow smuggler, not just any Muslim.
But with families in shock and seeking justice, India's cow protection squads are under scrutiny.
Leila Nathu reporting from northern India. And staying in India, police in Delhi have told the Supreme Court that they've launched an investigation into sexual harassment allegations against the head of the country's wrestling federation. Top female wrestling stars had approached the court demanding action against Brij Bhushan Singh, who is also an MP from the governing Hindu nationalist BJP. He denies the allegations. The wrestlers are prominent figures in India, and they vowed to continue a protest in Delhi that they started this week. Our South Asia regional editor Ambarasan Etirajan says they feel their calls for an investigation have so far been ignored.
They launched their protest sit-in a few days ago, alleging that some of them had been sexually harassed by the chief of the Wrestling Federation of India, Brij Bhushan Singh, and some other coaches over many years. They're talking about 10 years. And one of those allegedly abused was an underage girl. So they were demanding action against Mr. Singh and other coaches. and asking them to be removed from their posts and then to launch a police investigation. And Mr. Singh and others, the Wrestling Federation of India, they strongly deny these charges, saying that these charges were politically motivated and those who are complaining of this, they have an ulterior motive. And the athletes wanted police. They went to the police to lodge a complaint. The athletes were complaining that the police were not launching this investigation, and that's why they went to the Supreme Court. And this hearing was going on for the past few days before the Supreme Court could give his final ruling. The government said that the police would now launch the investigation of the sexual harassment cases.
And the men involved, you say that they're suggesting that there's a political motive for this. Mr. Singh isn't just the head of the Wrestling Federation, is he?
He's a very influential man. He's a member of parliament representing the governing Hindu nationalist BJP. And many of these wrestlers feel that because of his political clout, the police were not willing to, at that time, to start the investigation. And they were also complaining that there had been indirect threats and then also telling them to withdraw their complaints. In fact, the original protest was started in January that attracted nationwide attention because probably this was the first in the Indian sports field. Such a massive allegations were raised, and also the very prominent, these were not like, you know, district level or village level wrestlers. These were Olympic medal winning and world championship winning athletes. The Indian sports ministry, the Indian government, they promised that they would form a committee to investigate these allegations. Now, what these athletes are saying now is that even after nearly 3 months, nothing has happened and Mr. Singh is still in his post. And some of these athletes feel because the main people are linked to the governing BJP, and that's why the action is not being taken against them.
Ambarasa Natarajan. On the first day of an official visit to Hungary, Pope Francis has given a warning about the dangers of populism and nationalism.
I think of a Europe that is neither a hostage to its parts, nor falling prey to forms of populism, nor resorting to supranationalism that loses sight of the life of its peoples.
Pope Francis was addressing political and religious leaders in Budapest, including the Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who has been criticised by several other European Union politicians for what they see as his populist and anti-immigrant rhetoric. Later today, Pope Francis will be speaking to Catholic youth, and he'll celebrate a public mass on Sunday. Nick Thorpe, our correspondent in Budapest, listened to Friday's speech.
He really had a message for everyone. There was this message about the dangers of nationalism and populism. There was an appeal, pretty thinly veiled appeal, to the Hungarian government, to the Hungarian people, really to show a more Christian spirit of welcome to strangers and refugees. Obviously, this was the main point over which the Pope was at loggerheads with the Hungarian authorities in the past. But there were also references to the current war in Ukraine. There were references to the family. He was full of praise for Hungary's policies to try and encourage couples to have more children, for example. So I think there was something in that speech for everyone, as well as criticism of different people here in Hungary and abroad.
And has there been any response to any of that criticism?
The Prime Minister, we know from his Chief of Staff that Prime Minister Viktor Orban said that his message to the Pope when they met, they had a brief meeting, just the two of them, was that Hungary is a Christian country and that his policies are Christian ones. Without Christianity, Hungary would not have survived through the ages, the Prime Minister told the Pope.
And just finally, Nick, he's got this stadium meeting with the youth of Hungary on Saturday. What else is being planned?
He's also got a meeting with refugees, including many refugees. I think the majority will be refugees from Ukraine. Over the last year or so, since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, he's sometimes been criticised by Ukrainians for his unwillingness to condemn or too sharply criticise Russia. So this will be a chance for him to meet Ukrainian refugees and express his, as he often does, his support for what he says, their martyrdom, the terrible things that have happened in Ukraine since the start of the war. But also in that meeting, he'll be meeting refugees from around the world. Again, most of them Christians, because Hungary doesn't allow many refugees into the country, but some Muslims as well.
That was Nick Thorpe. Still to come.
In 2017, it was discovered he'd fathered more than 100 children here in the Netherlands, where the limit is 25.
The man ordered to stop donating his sperm. We'll be right back after this.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair. Hours after her death, the only suspect in the case fled the UK to Yemen. He's never been questioned by the police. I'm Noelle McCarthy, and I made a promise to Martina's family 15 years ago to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair. Part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And we're back. Iran has announced it's to reopen its embassy in Saudi Arabia within days, adding that Riyadh will follow suit in Tehran. It marks a major development in ties between the former regional arch enemies. Here's Mike Thompson.
Iran and Saudi Arabia broke off diplomatic ties in 2016 after Riyadh's execution of a leading Shia cleric led to attacks on the Saudi diplomatic mission in Tehran. Since then, they've been at each other's throats, backing opposing sides in wars in Syria and Yemen, yet both finally agreed to restore relations in March. In an earlier development, Tehran revealed that the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, is to visit Syria next week. It'll be the first trip by an Iranian leader to this key regional ally since war broke out there in 2011.
Mike Thompson. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has created six new indigenous reserves. The new decree was signed at a summit of indigenous communities in Brasilia on Friday. Our America's regional editor, Phoebe Hobson, reports.
President Lula signed the decree standing alongside Brazil's indigenous minister. The demarcation of these territories gives indigenous people legal protection and grants them exclusive access to natural resources. The new reserves are the first to be created since 2018 and are a dramatic shift in policy from former President Jair Bolsonaro, who did not want to grant indigenous communities further rights. Environmental campaigners see the creation of the new reserves as key to protecting the rainforest. Mr. Lula da Silva said recognizing indigenous land was important to ensure Brazil reached the target of zero deforestation by 2030.
Phoebe Hobson. To the Netherlands now, where a court has ordered a man to stop donating his sperm after it heard he's thought to have fathered more than 500 children. Here's our correspondent in The Hague, Anna Holligan.
So what do we know about the man at the centre of this case? His name is Jonathan Jacob Meyer. He's 41 years old and a musician and very active online. This is one of the songs he's uploaded. In 2017, it was discovered he'd fathered more than 100 children here in the Netherlands, where the limit is 25. So he was placed on a blacklist. But that didn't stop him. Instead, he began donating abroad in Denmark, Ukraine, and offering his services online. It's unclear what motivated Jonathan Meyer, but there may be some clues in his YouTube videos.
Hi, thank you for watching a new video blog.
He claims birth rates are horribly low. He's been exploring his DNA.
I did my DNA test.
And likes to practice survival skills.
I have been bushcrafting or camping in the woods now for about a week.
Judges here in The Hague have just put an end to one of his hobbies. They warn Mr. Meyer he'd be fined up to €100,000 if he ever tried to donate his sperm again. No more advertising online, and he's been told to provide a list of all the clinics he used and order them to destroy his sperm. Apart from that reserve for parents who already have a child from him and may want a sibling for them. This case has highlighted the need for tighter controls. So the Netherlands is working on a central register to keep track of donors and stop them spreading their semen around numerous clinics. And the rules are changing so that a donor can provide sperm to 12 women max, replacing the current limit of fathering 25 children.
Anne Holligan in the Netherlands. Now, you might find the following difficult to listen to, but in recent years, scientists have realised the importance of our gut and its workings in relation to many diseases and conditions. US health officials have now approved the first oral pill made from healthy bacteria found in human waste to fight dangerous gut infections. Jason Goldsmith from the biotechnology company Ceres Therapeutics explains how its WOWST microbiome therapy works.
People often think about the bacteria in our gut as a purely harmful waste product. You know, we flush it down the toilet and then we clean the toilet. So you dispose of it and disinfect everything. But the reality is that much of the bacteria that are in intestines and our skin and elsewhere, we can get in all the spots that are bacteria. There's a lot more than people think about. They're actually highly beneficial and exist in a symbiotic relationship with us. But without them, we're not healthy. And that's really what the emerging field of microbiome therapeutics is all about. It's understanding how disruptions in this healthy pattern can lead to illness, and then designing ways to restore that healthy microbiome back to individuals to treat their illnesses.
The media are calling this development poop in a pill. So, James Gallagher, health and science correspondent, is that about right?
I don't really want to dump on this, but it's not really what you would call a poo pill. I mean, it's been inspired by poo, but it's not a poo pill. You're not swallowing poo when you do this. It's an idea of a therapy that's using some of the healthy and good gut bacteria that are inside your intestines that obviously come out when you do a poo, but it's taking those so that when you take the pill, you're taking tens of millions of these healthy gut bacteria.
And how does it work? What's it for?
It's for recurrent Clostridium difficile infections. So these are a really horrible infection in hospitals a lot of the time, and often in elderly people. And it's a weird thing where basically your gut bacteria go completely out of balance and Clostridium difficile, C. difficile, takes over. And that can be really quite unpleasant. So what you do when you treat that is you give people antibiotics, but that kills all the bacteria in there. And then it becomes a bit of a, like, almost like a flip of a coin. Is it going to be your healthy gut bacteria that take over, or is it going to be more C. difficile that takes over? And some people get what's known as recurrent C. difficile. They just get bout of it after bout of it after bout of it. The idea here is that you use antibiotics to clear everything out, and then you use this kind of like poo pill to repopulate it with the healthy ones before C. difficile gets the chance to take over.
It's been a therapy, an idea that's actually been around for a little while, isn't it?
There are actually some people who have had what are known as transfusions or fecal transplants. I mean, these genuinely are what they're called. And that's where you start with fecal matter and basically you put it through a fancy coffee machine, which basically percolates it out so that all the kind of like solid matter stays in the top and you get coming out a broth of gut bacteria and liquid. And that is given to people. But with fecal transplants, what you're doing is you're transplanting everything that's in somebody's feces, and you have to prepare that every single time you do it. And the danger is that you might transplant some not very nice gut bacteria in that process. So it has dramatically improved treatment of C. difficile, recurrent C. difficile, but there are also dangers. So the idea is that you can start to make it a little bit safer. So you can kind of think about this as kind of like purifying that, or making that approach slightly more sophisticated.
That was James Gallagher. And please don't try to replicate any of that at home. Now, this might sound like just another story about a shop in London, but it's so much more. The famous music retailer HMV is reopening its flagship store in London 4 years after the company went into administration. A surge in sales of vinyl, CDs and cassettes has helped make it become profitable again. The rebranded HMV shop, which is under new ownership, will return to 363 Oxford Street, the site of the original HMV store, opened in 1921 by the British composer Sir Edward Elgar. Our business correspondent Emma Simpson reports on the store, which began selling gramophones more than 100 years ago.
Madness, Amy Winehouse, The Beatles. Over the decades, 363 Oxford Street played host to an array of bands. It was a landmark institution where generations of music lovers spent hours browsing the shelves. Visiting the store to sign records in 1997, Sir Paul McCartney credited it with helping to launch the band in the early 60s.
Brian Epstein originally dropped off an early record of the Beatles to HMV, and they kind of picked it up and helped a lot supporting it. So I think, you know, it's good to come back and give them something back.
HMB closed in 2019 as it collapsed into administration, buffeted by rising costs and falling sales. Amid growing digital disruption, the chain was bought by the Canadian entrepreneur Doug Putman and has slowly been reborn. There are now 120 HMB stores in the UK, proof that the physical music store is still viable. Mr. Putman explained their appeal.
Coming into the store, not knowing what you're going to get or that you have a specific thing in mind, that browsing piece is a huge part of our business. We always like something tangible to have, to display, to collect.
It's 20 years since Steve Jobs launched iTunes, which turned the industry upside down. He created a streaming service which was easy, legal, and affordable, and synced it all up with the iPod. It was an instant hit. But vinyl has slowly made a comeback, and record sales are now at the highest they've been since 1990. HMV is making the most of the growing interest in vinyl. And in a nod to the old analogue era, it says it plans to bring out a small number of cassettes for a few specific new releases. A business that's going back to its roots of focusing on loyal music fans and in-store events to pull people in. The London store will reopen in time for Christmas.
Emma Simpson. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. Our producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Fifteen years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
Den norske studenten Martine Vik Magnussen.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Police investigating the murder of a Norwegian socialite in central London.
Her body was found in the building where the only suspect was living, Farouk Abdelhak, the son of one of the Middle East's richest and most powerful men. Before being questioned, Farouk fled from the UK to Yemen, where he's been ever since. I'm Noelle El-Makhafi. I made a promise to Martina's family over a decade ago to find out what happened and do what no journalist nor the police have been able to do until now. Find Farouk. Murder in Mayfair. Listen to the whole story now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.